Hi, this is Ted Price from Insomniac Games, and on this episode of Game Maker's Notebook, I had a really unique conversation with Maria Saenz, who is the CEO of Us2 Games. In our discussion, we went deep on several topics. In particular, we talk about the ethics of design. When I say ethics of design, I'm talking about how we as game makers interact with our players. What's right? What kind of behavior do we want to foment and encourage? What kind of behavior do we want to help players avoid? Maria also spends time talking about the importance of community management. And given her experience at EA, CCP, and Us2, everybody who is in development, especially if you're on the community side, should check this out.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
I'm Maria.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's good. Good. It's exciting to be here.
Well, we are here in Dubrovnik for Dice Europe, and I feel like I see you at almost every Dice.
Not quite. I think this is my third one.
Your third one. Okay.
Yes.
So you've been to a bunch of them.
I've been to two in Barcelona.
Okay.
It just sort of didn't happen for a couple of years, but now I'm back because I love it. I mean, it's such a great environment, such a close, relatively small size of people that you get to ask questions and learn from other people in a way that you don't normally at other conferences. Or I'm not here to do a lot of meetings. I am here to listen and to ask questions and to, you know, because there are people who've gone through similar things that I'm going through and maybe... Yeah, just look to learn. Yeah, so I really, really value it.
Do you find that you continue conversations after DICE outside of the conference?
In some cases, yes, with some people. Yeah, that's been it's opened some good conversations afterwards with some mostly European based people for some reason. But yeah.
Well, I mean, we are here at DICE Europe, so we do have a lot of European developers and publishers here, which is great.
Yeah,
I think for those of us from America, it's really nice to meet another segment of the industry that we don't get to interact with too often.
Yeah.
And you and me, for example, we don't get to talk frequently.
No, it's true. I mean, I've only met you here, so in this environment, and I you spend so much of your working day kind of focused on what you're doing. You know, a subset of like, what's the game I'm working on? What are the people I'm building partnerships with? What are the companies that I have some form of dealing with? And you don't often sort of kind of step out and look around and have more of that broader perspective. So I see this as an opportunity to do that.
I agree. So let's talk about getting into games.
Yeah.
So what was it like growing up? Did you play a lot of games?
I played some games, but not a lot of games. I played... I played what was around. I think my kind of most distinct gaming memory probably is from playing on my dad's Apple, some like text adventure, and he had it on a little cart with wheels, right? And so I remember moving the entire thing around so that my back would be to the wall and I could see the door because I was so immersed in this like little green text on black screen that I was just like, I need to be more aware of my surroundings because it's a little bit too immersive.
Yeah.
It was a Bond adventure or something like that. But I didn't play a lot of games growing up. It was mostly if like friends had something and I would play it. I would play it with them and a little bit, as an adult, I started playing more games. I was a business analyst with a consulting firm when I first came out of uni, and we had simulations or models rather to run on our computers that would take hours to run, And so I'd be up in the middle of the night playing kind of SimCity while the model that I had running next to me was simulating like the European airspace or the European airport market or something like that. So it was something to kill time while I was waiting for some sort of calibrations or calculations to happen.
That's great. Well, so you went to Stanford, right?
I went to Stanford. I started out as a management consultant, and it was kind of like the path was you start, you join the firm, and then they would say like, oh, you're good. You know, we want to invest in you. We'll pay for you to go to business school. Then you'd get accepted somewhere that sponsor you there, and then you owed them 2 years of your life. So I was lucky enough to get accepted at Stanford, went to Stanford, and then when I came back, I owed 2 years of my life to to this firm. But when those 2 years were up, I kind of like took a step back and I said, okay, I've done these things so far. I've seen all of these industries. I've worked in many many countries, and but what do I really want to do with with the rest of my life? What are my kind of my sources of passion, and so it was the time, I think this is the time sort of the PS2 just came out, and I think games had had a lot of salience in popular culture at the time, and I had played some games, but it was the first time that I took a step back and I thought, okay, what are the things that I really care about or that spark my joy and my curiosity are all around technology, entertainment, and working with young people. And so what are, like, once I realized that those are the things that I wanted to be engaged with and I wanted to be engaged with them forever, then it was like, well, what about games? Because games seems to be kind of where those three things meet. And I thought, isn't it weird that none of my classmates from Stanford went into games? Isn't it weird that none of my sort of former McKinsey colleagues are in games? It turned out not to be true. It turned out that there were some, but I just had to dig around to find them. So once I realized that, I thought, well, I think games is where I really want to be. So I was lucky enough to find a former McKinsey consultant that was at the time running EA Europe, Gerhard Florin. And I picked up the phone and I called him. I said, like, you don't know me, but I want to work for you. And I think he humored me because at the time it was pretty random that it was unheard of, right? That somebody coming from outside of the industry with my background would say, I really want to work in games. And so he, he met me and then introduced me to David Gardner, who was his boss at the time. And they said, okay, we like you. What do you know how to do? And I said, well, I know how to do CRM, databases, that kind of thing. Like, oh, that's interesting. Come and do that for us. That's what I started doing at EA. It was, it was about 2000.
Okay.
2001. Yeah.
So did you get heavily involved with development at some point?
Not to begin with. So I think my career at EA, so I was at EA for 14 years, and I started out doing like online services. So I started out sort of creating websites for the studios and for their games, but from the websites, then creating online experiences that kind of expanded what the game was. Things like leaderboards, or things like communities and forums, and eventually things that were a little bit more integrated with the games. But at some point, I realized that I had become a bit of a functional expert in games, and I was outside of the core development, and I really wanted to get closer to the creative side of it. And that's when I moved more into more traditional product marketing. So I did sort of a more traditional product marketing phase. I started out working on Spore with Will Wright and like looking after the European marketing of that. And then from that, I moved on to BioWare, and I was doing the European marketing for all of the BioWare games between Dragon Age Origins until the Old Republic and Mass Effect 3, actually. And then it was only after that that I moved studio side. Mm-hmm. So my role had been very publishing focused. And when the opportunity came to move even to a studio and closer to development and closer to the creative side of things, I jumped on it. So that meant moving my family to Sweden to work at DICE on Battlefield. Yeah.
And was that when you started the Game Changers program or started?
So Game Changers program was started in sports originally. Okay. I think it was Game Changers had originally started in, I don't know if it was NFL or it was FIFA, but we took it to, it was then that we took it to Battlefield.
Well, that was, I think, where it made the impact. I remember you gave yes. a great talk on it, mm-hmm. and you were talking about how you involve players in the development process.
That's right, yeah.
So that was, I'm thinking, pretty unusual for a traditional publisher, right? I mean, most of us who are mm-hmm. in development think this is a challenge to actually balance secrecy with what players want and exposing players to what you're building. How did you manage to make that work?
So I think the journey to get to that point had been a long journey. And I think it was the culmination of a lot of conversations that had been going on at EA, not just on Battlefield, but for example, on BioWare, how much we brought the players in, what we showed. And I think we had already started to experiment with some of those things at BioWare. And a lot of it inspired actually by CCP, who I later went to work for, who had been leading on that front. So I think the seed had been planted over the years that if we kind of open the kimono, we can bring the players in, we show certain things. But it had been a more informal process. And I think what changed with Game Changers was that it took a more formal role, and a formal role in terms of how many players we have, how do we source them, how do we make sure they represent our player base more thoroughly rather than just a subset, and how do we involve them over time? And I think and that's gone on to become, I think, a cornerstone of how EA kind of deals with communities, deals with development, and I left EA now 4 or 5 years ago, but my understanding is that they've continued to do that. So I think the challenge is, I think actually DICE was really hungry for that at the time, and we had come out of a challenging launch with Battlefield 4, and there was a desire to heal in a way in our relationship with our players. So the development team was very open to it, and I actually think that once we started implementing that, it gave us in the studio not just a lot of knowledge but also a lot of power, because then we could justify a lot of the decisions that we were making, and a lot of the path that we were choosing to follow with other stakeholders in the company.
Did you bring some of that to CCP with you?
I did, but CCP had fallen in. CCP was drinking from the hose of community. They were years ahead of us in this. I mean, they started out their CSM, their Council of Stellar Management, I don't know what year exactly, but definitely, 10 years ago. But even then they'd gone through cycles of very good relationship and dysfunctional relationship and good relationship, and then it gets dysfunctional. So it's not a smooth I think once you decide to embrace the community and open development to the community, it's never going to be a smooth ride, and you have to be ready to go with the ups and the downs. And I think CCP takes that to an even deeper level, because their community representatives are democratically elected by the players, right? At least at EA, we kept a certain amount of control where we would select who those people would be. And at CCP, that's, you know, the only power was to kick somebody out of the CSM if they misbehaved.
So were those situations where the downs occurred? You mentioned there were ups and downs.
You know, actually, when a player who is part of a CSM or a body like this misbehaves publicly.
What's an example of misbehaving?
Misbehaving is revealing information that they shouldn't have revealed, typically, or using the information that's been made available to them about how the company is going to adapt certain systems, for example, to their own gain, which in a game like EVE Online means like financial gain, and means like, you know, can make quite a difference to the power balance in the game. So when they misbehave like that, actually the rest of the player base respects you for following through with the rules. I actually think the downs come from when you're not being clear enough about your expectations, clear enough about your boundaries, when you're pretending to be transparent, but you're not transparent. And I think so typically those downs happen when you don't have a strong person or team in charge of managing the process. And that's when it goes wrong, in my experience. So people who don't follow through on promises that are made in those contexts, or who bring in things or topics to that conversation that are way too early or actually don't have the internal support to make it happen. So mismanagement on the developer side is typically what creates those downs, because their relationship erodes and trust erodes. And then it starts being a hindrance instead of the wind beneath your wings.
Well, CCP, as you're implying, was able to get it back, get the trust
absolutely
back from players.
Yes.
And what did it take? Was it difficult after a misstep?
So I'm thinking specifically, because this is like, this happens cyclically, right? Cyclically,
right.
There'll be times when things go up and down. But in one particular case I have in mind, it was very clear that the source of all the dysfunction in that relationship with the community was from just not having a strong person leading the community team or leading the interaction with the CSM. And so we changed that. So, we recognized that the person who was leading that relationship was great in many ways, but didn't have the right personality to manage that conversation. So we put that person on another role, and we brought in somebody else to manage those proceedings of the CSM, the agenda, the communication, the follow through, and all that.
So for anybody who is running a large community of players, what kind of personality is optimal?
I think community management is one of the toughest roles in the industry. And I think that the right personality is somebody with a lot of empathy, but with a very thick skin. So, somebody who is, who cares enormously for our players and for the game, but also is not afraid to set those boundaries and set them early and quickly and clearly. I think dysfunctions happen when community leaders or community managers are too much of a personality. So they develop too much ego And I think that always ego gets in the way, but in this particular case, I think more than anything, where they develop too much of authoritarian style when they are not listening. And then on the other extreme, when they have too much empathy, but not the ability to define those boundaries. So to me, that's, yeah. So, and a good sense of humor is like fundamental, because drama is kind of happens every day. And so you have to be able to navigate that drama, I think. Yeah. But they are, I mean, good, solid, like, you know, community leaders and community managers are like, I would say, I was going to say the unsung heroes of our industry. I think they're not unsung, like, but they need even more celebration, because I do think that they make or break a game. Yeah.
I think you're right. We don't see a whole lot of elevation of community managers. We don't see a lot of speeches from community managers or them standing up and saying, here's how I do it.
Yeah.
Perhaps that's an opportunity as we look ahead to how to make things better for players, right? Cultivating a new wave of community managers who understand. So the community manager in particular for CCP, or the community managers, how many players are they ultimately helping? I mean, it's thousands and thousands and thousands, right? Hundreds of thousands of players. How does that work? How can you, I mean, you said that that person has to have a thick skin, but how does one actually parse what's important from what must be a myriad of very loud voices?
I think, so one way to look at it, when you talk about 100,000, right? One way to look at it is that there are different tiers in the community. And it's not always like tiers of concentric circles, right? It's more like spheres that they touch each other. Like they are within a large enough game that has multiple ways of playing it, there are there's the competitive sphere, the people who the way that they play the game is competitively, it's aggressively, they see it mainly as a PvP game, and so they care about certain things. And there are people who will be builders, there are people who are socializers, and there are people who are solo players, right? And I think that this is the case, obviously, on EVE Online, because it's such a deep and complex game. But I also think that it's applicable to other games that are a little bit more streamlined in the way that they are played. Not everybody plays the game the same way. And so a way for a community team or a community leader to think about this is that you don't interact with everybody. You interact with these different spheres, and you're just making sure that you're listening to, like, to proactively going to seek feedback from not always the people who are the loudest. Another way to think about it is that these days in most companies, the community team is very deeply connected with a customer experience team, so what used to be formerly known as customer service. And so you've got like workflows and communication that deal with information that's happening from an interaction with an individual player to information that is emerging from forums to information that is emerging from focus groups. And so one of the things that we did at CCP was to bring all of these sources of information together into a series of like regular meetings, so that on a regular cadence, say weekly, you're looking at what is my CSAT survey saying, and what are the problems that people are finding just generally through surveys. What does the customer service team, customer experience team, what have they seen this week? What are the key things that are happening this week? What's happening on the forums? What's happening on a playtest that we run? And what's happening on social? And bring this in into a ongoing top 10, top 20 list of issues that are constantly being monitored and constantly being kind of addressed in terms of, are they like code red or code, you know, green, and then moved on to a priority list. So that making sure that you have this conversation regularly, and that and that it has multiple sources of information, not just the forums, because the forums are going to be where the loudest, angriest people are going to be talking. And I think that a good community manager is also they have to be quite, you know, quite smart, because navigating all of this to say, okay, this actually, I think that this is a problem that only a few people are talking about in the forums, but it affects 50% of our player base and they're just not talking about it. So if only these few people are experiencing it, but there is a lot of like silent majority that we should, and we should bring this up to the top of our priority. So I think that that sort of flow of information is crucial. Yeah,
That's great. I don't think we've ever talked about community management on this podcast, and I hope community managers are listening, because I mean, seriously, this is it's really, really good information from probably one of the biggest and most community sensitive games out there. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about this forever, but I do want to move on from CCP to Us2. Mm-hmm. And you are now CEO of Us2. And what led you to that?
So about a year ago, I left CCP and I decided I wanted to take some time off. I wanted to refresh and re-inspire and sort of, you know, figure out what I wanted to do next. But one of the things that I did, in fact, I wasn't even sure that I wanted to stay in games. Like, well, maybe this is the time I grow up and get a non-gaming job and let down my earlier self, who thought she'd be working in games when she's a little old lady of 70. So I took some time off. But one of the things that I did is I took a board role with Us2. And that was just 2 days a month kind of thing to help their to help the owners of the company and the management team kind of improve the communication there and better understand each other. They thought that I was bringing, you know, my games experience, but also my business background, and that would help improve some communication challenges that they've been having. So I went and did a whole bunch of like nonsense things and had a lot of fun and spent some time with, you know, with my family and actually learning what my kids do every day. But all this time I kept my little toes like on the gaming industry. And I'm really glad I did that, because as I started to look into other industries, and I was, you know, going out and meeting with my former McKinsey colleagues, and with people in, I thought maybe I should do edtech, and maybe I should do fintech, and maybe I should do some kind of B2B services, blah, 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 whatever. In all of these meetings and all of these conversations, I just didn't get the sparks. I just didn't get the energy and the passion. And then I'd be looking forward to my board meetings with Us2, where I would just be so excited about, okay, where's the game at, and what's happening so far, and what's happening with this partnership and that partnership, and what's inspiring you. And so through that, I just realized actually I love games and I want to stay in games. So I took some consulting roles as well within the games industry at that point, and I was in conversation with a couple of different people. But my relationship with Dan, who was a studio manager and had been running the company so far, and he was part of the original Monument Valley team, was a great relationship, and we really, we developed a lot of trust, and we really enjoyed working together, and with Pash, who is our technical lead in the company, and they kept asking me to do, hey, can you help us with this partnership? Can you come and help us with our, can you help us put together a strategy plan for the next few years? Can you help us look at how we do this? And sort of little by little, I was spending more time with them. And then Dan, to his credit, you know, just realized that that what he really loves is making games. And part of what the challenges were that he just didn't really enjoy the business side of things that much, and that he was being pulled into too many directions. And so he said, well, you know, why don't you come and run the company for us? The owners were very excited by that prospect as well. And yeah, but I mean, I think the origin of that, you have to go back to 2014, really, when I was working at DICE and was in the middle of we just launched Battlefield. It was like the Battlefield 4. It was some really tough months in the studio after the launch of Battlefield 4. And I have this like really powerful, distinctive memory of me in the tube, the train going back home, playing Monument Valley in the train, and saying, what is this beautiful thing? Who are these people? And then Googling it, and they're like, and they're just a bunch of random people in London who don't even make games. Like, why do they get to make something so beautiful and just perfect? And I think that idea of, you know, so I'd admired them for a while, and I had almost respected and envied that ability to have an outsider's point of view to games, to come at it from just, you know, I think those of us who work in games are just very insular very often. Like, we just keep looking at each other and did you play this and did you play that? And that's lucky when we're even playing other people's games. I've worked in studios where they don't play other people's games, and all they do is just they look at their game and their game and their game. And so I think it was very refreshing to see something that was really coming at it from a completely different angle. And having met them and spent time with them over the last year, you can see how they live and breathe that. They, you know, they have a very sort of clear sense of who they are and what they want to bring to games, and which is lovely and exciting.
Well, yeah. Astu does much more than games, right?
That's right. So Astu is a group, right? Astu Games is the games company, which is what I run. And then there is a sister company called Astu Studios, and they do digital sort of client services, innovation. They've just actually been, they just made some very cool sort of top 30 design, most important design companies in the world, according to Fast Company. So they're very, very successful and innovative in their client services business. And then they have a third leg of the business, which is, they call it Adventures, which is really like an investment, the investment arm of the group. And they invest in creative-led technology businesses, but in a very kind of, in a very sustainable way. So they're focused on entrepreneurs that have a kind of, you know, sustainable approach to how to growth and how they take on investors. So it's a really special, really special place. I think the culture, not just of Astu Games, but of the group in general, comes very much from the two founders, who are less involved in the business these days, but they are childhood friends, Sinks and Mills. Shout out to Sinks and Mills, who I'm sure are going to be listening to this one day. And they are incredible. So they're entrepreneurs who've been through a journey, and they have approached the ups and downs of building a business from a very human place. And I honestly haven't met or worked with people so far who care so much about the people that they have in their businesses, and about powering, enabling, unleashing the creativity of those people. And it's very, very refreshing to be in an environment where you've got, you know, two owners that have a very long-term approach with and very, very values driven. And I think that that transpires to everything that we do.
Yeah. Well, I think that cultural statement also translates well to what you've been talking about here at DICE. Mm. I was on a roundtable with you yesterday, and the topic was around whether we're being responsible mm-hmm. for our players yeah. in the industry. Mm-hmm. And you made a lot of bold statements, I think, in your description of the roundtable. And I'd love for you to elaborate a little bit about mm-hmm. how you think, whether you think our industry is being responsible mm-hmm. for our players and maybe where we aren't being responsible.
Mm. I mean, I think we are being responsible for the most part. I think we can definitely do better. And I, you know, I one of the things that kind of stood with me yesterday on the talks here at DICE was, I think it was Robin saying, we are what we play. And I fundamentally believe that. I think that the games have the ability to touch you and to interact with you in a deeper way than almost any medium. And I think that games are going to be, you know, where we're going, everything's going to be a game. So people are going to be spending even more time playing games than they do today. And games are going to be serving even more needs of us as humans. But I think that today and so far we've been very defensive as an industry. We've stood strong when people have challenged us. And I think it's great because we have reasons to be proud and reasons to defend what we do. But I think that now we're not that young industry that has to defend itself all the time. I think that we can take a little bit, perhaps a more proactive approach. And I think that, there was a round table that wasn't mine, that was about ethical pricing and free-to-play models. Yep. So I think that, that's... Some people are obviously talking about that. There was somebody presenting today about how to ethically navigate the technologies that are coming our way. And so obviously, I think this is a theme that more and more people are realizing that perhaps we need to have more conversations about.
What are some examples for you of places where we may not be thinking hard enough about ethics mm-hmm. in pricing and systems for games?
I think today there's definitely things that relate to time, time in games.
Okay.
And I think that there is a, before you go all the way to game addiction, right? Even if you don't go all the way there, there are ways and things, ways in which we could be doing more to make it easier for a player to kind of just stop playing when it makes sense for them to do.
How do you know that though? I mean, speaking as somebody who is interested in immersing players
yeah.
and ensuring that they feel that there's something that's unforgettable, something that pulls them in and makes an impact. Mm-hmm. How do you decide when enough is enough? Right, from a player's perspective, if you're designing a game,
I don't think it's about deciding when enough is enough, and I think that what you're pointing at is perhaps one of the risks is that other countries or regulators might take a ham-fisted, is that the expression in
yeah.
English, ham-fisted approach to this and say, well, these are the rules, and this is when enough is enough. And these are the rules that you have to put in place. And I think that is just perhaps not the best way to deal with it. But I think that the more that you give players options, and the more that you take a step back and make sure that you are not designing the game in a way that requires that requires and rewards those exceedingly long sessions or those or that frequency of check-in or the type of things that really start to get in the way of your life. So there is no like one solution, like from when you go from, you know, from free to play games to an idle games, and you go to all the way to, you know, MMORPGs and triple A or quadruple A console games. Like the solutions and the problems are very, very, very different.
Well, let's talk about some, because I think that's where it would be great to get specific for and give some ideas out to listeners. Like let's say triple A games, for example, or MMOs, right? Where you have experiences that are visually arresting, perhaps, and there's a lot of time and money and effort that goes into making these experiences. And I know from a designer's perspective, usually we're talking about what does it take to have people say, okay, just one more level, or just another chapter of the story. And it's like episodic TV. You want people to be compelled to see what's next.
Yeah.
Is that right? Is that wrong? Is there, you talk about mechanisms that will help players, I think, detach and feel good about having had the experience and want to get back in. What would you recommend for designers in terms of thinking differently about design?
Well, I think so. One of the things is just a basic one is to ask yourself, like, what's the consequence of the player on the player of me creating this system? So, for example, so go back to The Sims, right? Long time ago, like you'd sit down to play The Sims, and you'd blink, and 4 hours later, you would still kind of going to pee and getting your food and going to work, and you think, how did that happen, right? I love The Sims, and I doubt that any of this was intentional, but not creating natural save games on an experience like that was perhaps not in the player's best interest. So that's an example, you know, creating sort of natural save places. Most games these days are saving kind of along the way, so you always feel like, you know, it's from that point of view, like it's sort of
it's okay to step away,
but they don't create the moment in which you feel, okay, I've kind of achieved this, and there's a moment for me to step away.
Let me ask you about another example that's one of my favorites, Assassin's Creed, right? The Ubisoft games, Assassin's Creed, and both Assassin's Creed and Far Cry, I think, do a great job of giving you rewards and awards for achieving things in the game, large and small. But there's always the feeling that there's something just around the corner that is even an even bigger reward. Do you feel like those games give players the chance to detach, take a breath, or is it a compulsion loop that is so compelling that it's tipping over into the good?
So I don't feel I think AAA games are less of a victim of this because in a way they've already taken your money. And so they, you know, they don't have to work for your engagement at the same level that a free-to-play game does.
You said that perhaps we can do better than just defending ourselves when under attack. What would you like to see the industry doing differently?
I mean, I think that some of these things are starting to happen, right? Just the fact that there were a couple of other talks here that were approaching this topic of how can we approach these decisions from an ethical standpoint. So I think one of the things that I would like to see happen is more of those conversations. It's as simple as that.
Where should those conversations occur outside of DICE? Because I think DICE, GDC, they're fantastic venues. But if we want to spread the knowledge and make the conversation wider, what else can happen?
I think GDC would be a very good place, and perhaps that's something, you know, to think about on like an ethics track. I think that's a great place. I think to a certain extent it's been happening in the press, like, you know, obviously it's been more around, but that's driven more by sort of when something goes wrong and sort of digging into that in a proactive way. I think that there's definitely like education, right? And those are, I'd love to see a world where people who are learning to develop games have like, you know, a course on ethics, perhaps. A course on sort of how do you think about the impact that this has on a player? What are tools for you to think two steps ahead, not just one step ahead, but like if this connects with this and this connects with that, what impact is that going to be on the player? What am I telling the player about, like, you know, what's important or not important? I think the other thing that I like to see is, you know, perhaps, you know, we were talking about this, is more sort of casual conversations. You know, I've been approaching different people in my sort of my circle in London in trying to sort of find sort of, you know, people who care about these topics. Because I'm not an expert. I'm trying to find sort of paths here. And I do think that that it takes many voices. People that work deeply in free-to-play, people that work deeply in communities, because that's another element, right? We're creating another element of all of this is sometimes we create toxic communities by design and we don't even realize and we just step into this. And in the types of behaviors that we've encouraged and the types of rewards and how we facilitated communications have created a cesspit. And I think that's actually another component of this. I think, for example, Roblox is doing a great job there of being proactive in thinking about civility and how do you encourage and educate young people in being more kind of civil members of an online society, and so not just monitor it and police it, but encourage the right behavior. So anyway, I think finding, you know, conversations, well, like this, but conversations, GDC conferences, those would be a very, very good starting point.
How about an ethics council or ethics cafe, for
example? An ethics cafe.
Which you mentioned to me yesterday.
Yes. So the idea of the council, the idea of the cafe, they're different things. I think that there is the idea of the council is more something like a nonprofit that actually writes like and researches white papers and that maybe provides works as a center to be consulted when a development team or a company has concerns about and questions about what they're doing. What if there was a circle of experts, right, that have been looking into this and that could be consulted not necessarily an open basis, on a private basis. You can go and say, okay, we're thinking about these changes. We're thinking about these features. Can you help us think about sort of the implications of what we're going through? So having somebody like that as a nonprofit body that you could access, I think that would be a tremendous resource. The idea of the cafe is more of a private forum, right, for people who are interested in something like this, and that's something that I've been, you know, talking about. So, you know, I'm Stealth Crystal on Twitter. So if you're kind of UK based and want to talk about about these topics, you know, it's something that you know, perhaps we'll get a meetup started and a regular forum where we can explore these topics, identify who the experts are, identify resources, and then I don't know, take it from there.
Well, it'd be great if maybe you could expand it further with Skype and
have
people from
that's a good idea
outside of England.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But I think that's fantastic. Look into that. I would hope that out of that comes some sort of suggested guidelines for developers or mm-hmm. potential developers, people who want to get into the industry,
yeah.
just so that the ideas can start to get seeded. It's mm-hmm. difficult for, especially for those of us who are heads down in development most mm-hmm. of the time, to take a step back and look at those questions. Are we being ethical for our players?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I couldn't begin to talk about the different categories that we need to consider, mm-hmm. but you've already got them, right? You've already been thinking about this, and yeah. to have them out there would be fantastic for mm-hmm. the industry.
Very often the core problem is your business model. And unless you change that core business model, it's going to be very, very difficult to solve some of these issues kind of structurally, because you know, water flows kind of downhill. And you were asking me earlier about some of my experience with loot boxes and my time at EA. And you know, for years, you know, people would talk about like, oh, we want this to change, or we think this would change. Is this really right? Should we change this? The problem is that once you're inside of a company and there's so much of it that is about the momentum of a large company and the momentum of decisions and priorities. And so things like this are so structural to how a company operates that you can't count on sort of like individuals sort of raising a question. And, you know, people around them will say, oh, I agree with you. Yeah, that's a very good question. It's just, let's work on that after we work on A, B, and C, okay? And then it just never happens. So I think some fundamental things just have to do with you know, the business, with the core of the business, of the business models, which is why, you know, in you know, working at Astu Games right now, I think one of the things that we hold dear to how we view the games that we make is that we want to make sure that we are not subject to a business model that doesn't allow us to, that limits the type of games that we want to make. So you have to decide in a way sort of what pools or what where do you want to operate? Because I think that although it's possible to operate ethically in almost, you know, almost every business, with there are certain things that will make it a little bit harder for you to make those right decisions, like on an ongoing basis, day in, day out, I think.
Well, let's then talk about the business model a little bit, because you know, both of us are involved in a sort of a commodities-based game business, where Monument Valley is a premium game. Mm-hmm. Games that we make are also premium games, but for console. Mm-hmm. And the challenge that we usually face is that as the budgets go up, the prices aren't changing. Mm-hmm. I know on the mobile side, there's a ceiling when it comes to how many games you can sell and the amount of revenue you can generate. So how can you be responsible for players, but it create additional sources of revenue that can support the increasing cost of satisfying player demands?
I would question this perception of player demands. I think that
that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that necessarily. I often feel that we inflate games as a way to kind of, because it's the safest thing to do, because the hardest thing to do is to cut down and to streamline So I think, yes, the increasing cost of satisfying success in the industry as it is right now, and that success in the industry, in a particular pocket of the industry, is so much defined by its business model, its distribution model, and therefore its pricing strategy. And so I think, and you know, maybe I'm naive, maybe I'm optimistic. I have quite a lot of faith, or I'm optimistic for like subscription models to create a more transparent pricing and financial relationship with players, and for them to provide the freedom for game makers to create experiences that you know, that are really more kind of, you know, focused on what we really want to make instead of, you know, we're never going to be completely free of the business model, right? Because you need to be successful then in that environment. But I think that the size of games and the size of those experiences and the way that we deliver them, I think we'll find there'll be kind of like a new equilibrium that will emerge out of that, I think. I don't know what that is. In my case and my side of the industry, I do think that we've been limited in terms of, you know, you said a ceiling in premium mobile games. I think that ceiling has come from, and we've been very, us too has been very successful in there. But I think that ceiling comes also from competition with free to play. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to justify. But I do think that that there is untapped appetite for, you know, 2 hour experiences, and I think that, you know, within a subscription model, we'll be able to serve more of those needs, and we'll be able to serve like different consumers that are going to enjoy experiences like that.
What would be an ideal subscription model? How would that work for us too?
Ideal for whom?
Well, for the developers.
Mm.
And I know there's, I mean, we can talk about players and developers. Maybe there's one that satisfies both, that actually gives developers enough of an upside to take creative risks,
yeah,
right? And continue to push the boundaries of what they're delivering. And then gives players the choice that you're describing, right? In an ethical way.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, this is transparent. I know what I'm getting. I know what my subscription choices are every month. Do you have something in mind, or have you seen examples that are heading in the right direction?
I mean, I think a lot of the services out there, are kind of heading in that direction. I think, both Sony and Microsoft have, you know, subscription services that players enjoy and that have been growing over the last few years. In our case, coming from the mobile, you know, Apple Arcade, we're obviously very mindful of like what that's going to be with Amidst Public, that we've got one game coming out on that service, and so we're, you know, really keen on that. I think that the proliferation of multiple subscription services is something that, from a consumer perspective, will be confusing and frustrating. I don't know that there is an alternative, or that it's better to have just one. In general, I think, you know, more choices better than less choices when it comes to this. But I think the question for me for us as developers, and the concern is that beyond sort of, you know, the revenue model after sort of in the subscription service is unclear. You know, a lot of it in some of these cases is going to be like, you know, it's the algorithm that will define it. You know, if I talk to my friends that are in the film business, they talk about the relationship with Netflix, and they talk about the fact that this is what Netflix pays for this type of content, and they become, you know, content cost plus businesses, where you are, you know, this is what it costs to make this film, and this is, you know, and I can charge this extras, and this is what Netflix will pay me to create it. Obviously, we don't want to be there, right? Because in a way, you become a glorified developer for hire. So we're hoping that that's not the way this evolves. And being somebody or a company that's mostly focused on single player games, it worries us that some of these services will reward disproportionately multiplayer games. I do think that eventually they recognize that content that is a value creator for the service comes in many shapes and forms, and it's not necessarily about sort of more sessions. And I think that the smart platform owners will understand that very quickly. Although I'm concerned a little bit about that, I do think that that would be just a phase. That and I think that as we look into our future, there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of which of the platforms that are going to be the most successful, the services that we should be in, the partnerships that we should be making. Should we be, just continue to make mobile games or go into, multiple platforms? And I think it's a moment of great uncertainty in the industry. And the best way to navigate that, I think, is to just, focus on what you do best. Focus on creating your own IP, and then have relationships with these partners that are good, good relationships, but a couple of them. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. for a short while, don't take on really long development cycles. there's a sense of, what does our environment going to look like 3 years from now? There's a lot of uncertainty. I can tell you like 18 months from now, maybe, but 3 years, that's starting to be quite further down the line.
What would you like to see in 5 years? Let's just paint a picture of Maria's favorite future.
Maria's favorite future. Maria's favorite future is I don't even know how to answer that question. I think I have to go back to the games that I love, and I'd like to make sure that there are more of those, and that there are more easily accessible and freely, and by free I don't mean price, but available. I think my desired future would be one that actually allows us to serve like many different players in many different ways. I think one of the things that I have liked less about the industry in the last 10 years has been the increasing concentration on a smaller set of games. Now, more recently, you've had indie games coming in and creating these varied experiences, but everything that was in between, it has kind of disappeared. I go back to kind of the years of EA when we were doing things like Dead Space just games that today, or Mirror's Edge. So games that today just are like, where are those games these days? The double A games that, and so I think part of it has been sort of the economics of the industry and the fixation on the $60 model. And it was either the $60 model or the free to play model, but there was in between, there was not a way for us to make games like that. And I'm hoping that we can find kind of more ways to make like more variety, to serve different players, and in different ways to tell more stories, more varied stories. I would love to see that. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you, Maria. And you mentioned this before, but I hope you can repeat it. How should people get in touch with you if they want to ask you more questions or become part of your cafe?
Yeah. On Twitter, I'm Stealth Crystal. I'm not super active on Twitter, but that's a safe way to find me. I'm only really, really active on Twitter around Eurovision season. That's when I go a little bit crazy.
Okay.
But most of the time, I'm just promoting the games I'm working on and initiatives that I find interesting. But yes, Stealth Crystal.
Great. Thank you, Maria.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you for listening to the Game Maker's Notebook. If you'd like to support the podcast and more content like this, please consider leaving us a rating and review. In addition to this podcast, the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences also produces the Dice Summit. To our listeners currently working in games, DICE Summit is the premier speaking and networking event in our industry. DICE will take place from February 11th to 13th at the Aria Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. Listeners will receive 20% off their DICE Summit registration with code GMN2020. To register or learn more, please visit www.dicesummit.org.